Welcome to Don't Give Up Your Day Job, the podcast, the only podcast you need. My name is Danny McCrum, and this is a special episode of the podcast. We have microbiologist and science communicator, Dr. Susie Wiles on the show. You know Susie, she's the lady with the pink hair. She's been all over the news since the pandemic broke out. I reached out to Dr. Wiles to see if she would be interested in talking to me about, more specifically, about the entertainment world and the impact the virus has had on all of our jobs and what we can plan for going forward and what we can expect and, you know, perhaps a few ways we could be a little more cautious or safer or, you know, strategic as we try, as we hope, to get back to normal. Now, this show is just an entertainment show. You know, we talk to our guests about their lives and careers, and we love to have a laugh, and we don't see ourselves as having any sort of great mission or anything like that. We're certainly not a political show. We're not trying to save the world or anything like that. I think that our guest stories are very useful to people. I think they're encouraging, and I think they're informative, and we can relax, you know, in making this show, that we don't need to push any certain point because our guest stories speak for themselves. But this one, I thought, well, I've got the opportunity to talk to Dr. Wiles, and I've got some questions, and I know everybody else does as well. The industry is made up of a lot of people, and when I talk about the industry, I'm not just talking about music as well. There are, you know, comedians, actors. There are so many different people out there working in the arts who now don't quite know what's going to happen next. It looks like there's going to be a transitional period where the crisis is still playing out, but we can sort of function to a point. We can get back to work probably even this week. I think we're a few hours away from the announcement now about whether we're going to go to level 2 or not. There's just so much uncertainty. When can we be out gigging again? When can film sets open again? And how can we plan to move forward safely and responsibly and get our industry going again while keeping ourselves safe? So I was allocated a short window with Dr. Wiles, and she gave me a little bit more time, which is nice of her. And I did my best, and hopefully this is interesting and helpful and, you know, can give us a little bit more perspective and a few more things to think about. So here is my conversation with Dr. Susie Wiles.
Now let's do this!
Don't give up your day job. When I first saw you on television a few months ago when everything was starting, my first reaction was, this seems all a bit exaggerated, like this seems a little bit over the top, you know, like who is this person? I wasn't sure if the urgency was justified, and then of course it turned out you were quite justified and it actually made a lot of sense. But how did you know so early that this was different, this was more serious?
Well, it's very interesting you say that, because I've actually had a lot of people tell me I was not taking it seriously enough in those early days. So it's really interesting. Yeah. So I guess if I think back to when I first did my first kind of interviews, that was in mid-January, and there still wasn't very much known about it then. No. So my job was to say, okay, so there's this thing that's happening in China, and you know, it's these things are always worrying, but at the moment there's nothing that would unduly alarm us.
Right.
So there is no, you know, it looked at that stage like it was, yes, it was human to human spread, but it didn't look like there were large numbers of healthcare workers dying. So it was a watch this space,
yeah,
kind of interview. And then 2 weeks later I got interviewed, and then it was like, well, this is escalating rather fast. And it all became about, you know, still, I mean, my approach has always been to not want to induce panic.
Yes.
So the research is really clear that when we panic, we don't act in our best interests or in everybody's best interests. So what I've tried to do with all of my media appearances up until we got into lockdown was to say, hey, so please don't panic, but here's what you need to do to prepare. And it sort of became more and more urgent. Please prepare. You know, I ended up drawing up a pandemic plan for my lab and making that available to everybody, saying, these are the things that I'm thinking about.
Right.
Maybe
right.
You should think about the same things type thing. And so it's so interesting, because lots of people have been like, you should have been yelling to shut the borders, and you should have been doing this, and you should have been doing that. And what I was trying to do was bring people with us. these are the things that we need to be thinking about. These are the things that we need to be thinking about as individuals.
Yeah.
you know, while having no control over things like whether we shut the borders or not. So it's been fascinating to see how people have responded.
Well, yeah.
Because there are, because obviously there are, you know, the vast majority of people in New Zealand, it would seem, are very pleased with us going down the path that we've taken.
Yes.
But there are people who are not pleased with that for various reasons. Because this is obviously very hard. But I've always been quite clear that what the information overseas is showing us is that if you don't act fast, this is devastating, absolutely devastating. And so my take has always been, I don't want to happen here, things like has happened in, you know, China and in Italy and now which are happening in more and more countries.
Right.
But yeah, it's been, and so there's people who, somehow they don't either don't think it's going to happen to us that way, or just don't think that that's a bad enough cost to pay. So I found it all very puzzling, I must say, how some people have responded.
Well, I think early on there was, my theory at least, is there was some hesitation or some skepticism because we live in a world where we have clickbait all the time. It's very noisy. There are conspiracy theories and fear-mongering and all that sort of thing, which means that when an important message has to be said, it gets diluted and people are a little bit more hesitant or cynical maybe about whether it's important enough. And we've also got recent memories of things like SARS and swine flu and even Y2K, you know, these things that were at the time were pitched as the end of the world, but then it wasn't. We got through them.
Yeah, but we got through them by action, right?
Exactly.
I mean, Y2K is a fantastic example where the reason it wasn't a complete catastrophe was because a whole bunch of people did a huge amount of work to make it not a catastrophe.
Exactly.
So this is why it's also really, I mean, what we have here is in an awful way an incredible experiment that is showing how, experiment, maybe the wrong word, but what we're seeing is how it plays out when different actions are taken.
Yes, that's right.
And so it's the complete opposite to Y2K, right, where there was just like it was a global thing.
Yeah.
This we're seeing on different levels in different places how different actions play out. And so I still really struggle with these people who are yelling at me that we overreacted, because I keep thinking, what are you watching? What are you looking at that you can't see that if we hadn't done what we did, we would be in a really bad place. So it's a worse place, I guess, than, you know, because clearly not, this is not a walk in the park for everybody. So, so I kind of struggle. I struggle with that. But I guess getting back to your original question of like why my area of expertise is infectious diseases. Like I follow these things. It's what I study. It's what I understand. And while I'm not a virologist, I study bacteria rather than viruses. I still know enough about them to worry. And so when we were seeing that data coming out of China, it was just like, whoa. And seeing them having to build hospitals in a matter of days so that they could care for the number of people who needed caring for, that was scary. That was like, okay, you know, and China have the capacity to do that. Mm-hmm. And all I could think was, oh, do we have that capacity? I'm not sure we do. And then as Italy started going through the same thing and the Italian doctors were yelling and saying, I'm having to decide who gets a ventilator and who doesn't. Again, I was thinking, well, I've seen the statistics and we don't have as many beds as they do, like hospital beds, and we don't have as many ventilators. So if that happened here, oh my God.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, that's where my mind was thinking. And it was very distressing. I mean, those few weeks before we went into lockdown are a bit of a blur. I wasn't sleeping.
Right.
I was feeling immensely ill watching what was happening, thinking, guys, this is going to be us in a few weeks' time. Because that's the other thing that's really frightening about this virus, is because it has this incubation period.
Yes.
We have this lag where we don't see our actions playing out for a couple of weeks.
And is that the most dangerous part about it? Is that the problem, the long incubation period?
It's one of the problems, yes.
Right, I mean, you know, that makes it worse than previous things, that we don't know if you've got it for 2 or 3 weeks and it spreads so easily.
Yeah, for about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And I guess there's that combined with the fact that people are infectious for a few days before they show symptoms.
Right, yes.
So with SARS, it was, people had a very characteristic, very high fever really early on.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very easy, or relatively easy, to identify people who had the virus and to isolate them.
Yeah.
And so that's why the heat scanners all worked. With this, not everybody has a fever, and if they do, it doesn't come on till quite late. Mm-hmm. And by then, they've already been at their most infectious.
Right, yeah.
And so that's what's really hard. Having a virus that spreads human to human when those humans don't realize they have it, and then has these, you know, kind of catastrophic effects, not in everybody, but in a significant portion of people.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah. And then the fact that you don't, you know, you have to wait. You have to wait.
Exactly.
Up to 2 weeks to figure out whether, you know, are you one of these people? It's just, yeah. And now we've seen that play out.
How do you feel now about going into level, I mean, we're in level 3 now and potentially going into level 2 soon. I mean, personally, I'm worried that we're just delaying the inevitable and there's going to be a big resurgence.
Yeah, well, it's really clear. We only want to do this once, right? The path we're on is an elimination path, but we want to get rid of the virus in New Zealand.
Yes.
That means we will be vulnerable because obviously there's still a lot of virus overseas. So right. We will need to be very careful about how we open up again to make sure that it doesn't get back into the country.
Right.
Or if it does, it comes and it gets stamped out really quickly. So that's the thing. But what we don't yet know, although, I mean, it's looking really good. It is looking really good for us being on that elimination path. But we don't yet know whether every case is, you know, whether every person who's infectious has done their dash and is no longer infectious.
Right.
And so the quicker and what we actually don't yet know is whether level 3 has been effective. So what we've been seeing with that, when we got down to 0 cases, that was a reflection of level 4.
Right.
It was like level 4 absolutely rocked. It really worked. It did what it needed to do. And then everyone got to level 3 and they're like, yay, no lockdown. And it was like, well, no, it's still lockdown. It's just slightly less lockdown, right?
Right, yeah.
And so what we don't know, because, you know, we had lots of reports of parties and all sorts of stuff. What we don't know yet is whether that has meant that the cases have started to rise again. And we won't see that probably until next week.
That's right.
Which is kind of when we're supposed to be moving to the next level, which if there are then cases, will be even, you know, there'll be even more opportunity for those to spread. And so what we don't want to do is end up basically back where we were in March with cases rising again. So it's just that, like, it's just a little bit more patience is needed.
Right. Well, that's why I was surprised that we're looking at moving out of level 3 so quickly.
Well, that's not, so that was never said. What
right.
was said was we were going to level 3 for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And then a decision was going to be made about where we moved.
I see.
Because we may have to move back to level 4.
Yes.
I do wish that it maybe had been made a longer, like we're going to stay here for 4 weeks and then, but we'll review it on the 11th. That would have been, I think, a bit more, people would have had a little bit more certainty rather than thinking, oh yes, actually on the 12th, we're going to move down to level 2.
Right,
But, you know, I don't make the decisions.
No.
None of us make the decisions.
I mean, do you feel like are you feeling hopeful at the moment that we are potentially past the worst of it, or is it too hard to answer that?
I think it's just too hard to say. I mean, it's really just like the next few days are the crucial ones.
Right.
You know, I mean, lots is being made of Australia and how Australia has managed to control the virus without doing what we have done.
Yep.
So I don't know whether anybody is talking to people in Australia, but my brother lives in Australia and I'm hearing plenty of like, well, yes, officially we're not at level 4, but it feels an awful lot like level 4 because the shops are shut and, you know, our kids are home and we're all home and stuff. So it's kind of interesting how unofficially they're behaving basically like us.
Right.
But officially it's not quite like that. But they're in Victoria, state of Victoria, so in Melbourne, they've just had a new outbreak happen over the last few days.
Oh.
So they had been tracking really, really, really low. Yep, everything's looking good. And then they've had something like 45 cases in the last 2 or 3 days.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So they have an outbreak now in a particular workplace. And it's unclear. Now, of course, remember, this is a reflection of infections that happened within the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So how many of those people were infectious and were moving around and were doing their thing? And so how many more cases are we going to see? Oh, bollocks. Sorry, the phone's just ringing. Hang on a second.
It's all good.
Sorry about that. Bloody landlines. We should get rid of it. The only people who ever call are the spammers.
I got rid of my landline years ago. I'm surprised you still have one.
I know. I'm sorry. We're so traditional.
But it is amazing to me now that there's a lot of criticism about the continuing restrictions because of the low numbers. When the low numbers are because of the restrictions, it's almost like you can't win either way. If they hadn't have done it and we had all those horrible numbers that a lot of the other countries have, we'd be complaining about the government not acting. But the government acted really well and we have really low numbers. Yeah. And they were like, well, what's wrong with you? Why can't we go out?
Yeah. And also those people who were like, you know, you said the hospitals will be full of people. Yeah. And, you know, like, no, we said the hospitals would be full of people if it didn't work. And we weren't sure how it would work and whether we'd acted too late. So we made sure we had enough beds and we cleared everything just in case.
Yeah,
as though somehow they, oh, I don't know, they wanted to see all the people in the hospital. It's weird. Yeah. I mean, I really struggle with this. And I just wish people were... I mean, I'm so grateful. Like, my parents are in the UK.
Yeah.
My mum is one of the however many millions got a letter from her GP to say, you have been identified as a vulnerable person, so you have to stay home for the next 3 months.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
And it's going to be longer than 3 months in the UK.
Yeah.
You know, and so, I mean, I'm really worried about her. They're really, you know, both my parents are really worried.
Absolutely.
They've now, I think, exceeded the rest of Europe and their death toll. And it's just like, why would anybody want that to happen?
Yeah.
It's this weird, also this weird thing about that those who would die are the vulnerable who are probably going to die anyway or something.
Yeah.
Like, what kind of argument's that?
It's a very Trumpy argument, I think, is the answer.
It's also a very, it's a very real lack of understanding of actually who is vulnerable.
Yes.
And it's not just people who are over 80.
Yes,
you know,
right.
There are many young people who would fit into the vulnerable category too.
Right.
And it's also some weird thing like they aren't part of our economy, or they aren't, you know, I mean, they're all like, there are people who are vulnerable who are active and healthy members of society who are doing, you know, who are contributing their thing. It's just, yeah, I find the whole thing a bit odd. My mental mindset just can't quite cope with it. It's weird.
Well, I mean, humans are very good at being selfish, aren't we? I mean, we're a very selfish species, aren't we? I mean, if it's us or if it's the people we love, then we care a lot more than, well, someone over there. Well, it's their problem, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's not how.
No, it's a crap attitude.
Again, the research. There's some really great research around kind of disasters and stuff, and so you know how we're. All the apocalyptic fiction we read and we watch and everything and the entertainment industry is all involved in is, you know, it's this kind of lone, usually a man, kind of a man with a gun who has his, is usually powerful with, you know, underlings who will do his bidding.
Yep.
And they kind of, they hide all the resources and they are like, we're going to get through this. It's sort of like the prepping type, you know, mentality.
Yeah.
But actually, like, real proper disaster research shows that the communities that survive disasters are those that come together, that share their resources, that put their guns away.
Right, yeah.
That think about everybody. How can we get everybody through this? It's
that's a
you know,
point.
Don't hoard your coffee, share your coffee
exactly.
type of mentality.
Exactly.
And that's what we need, because that's how we get through. And it's one of the reasons I'm so pleased that the way that this that what we are facing in New Zealand was framed as us being a team of 5 million. That yes, there will be people who don't do their bit for the team, but they should be in the minority because it is by working together that we get through this.
Right.
That's the most important bit. And so, you know, whereas in other countries, they've been put on more of like a war footing.
Right.
And that's just so problematic because we have people who, you know, if you get the virus, then you somehow failed, you know, if you spread the virus, you're stigmatized, even though actually, you know, it's just people being people going to a wedding or whatever. You know, these are not, you're not expecting when you go to a wedding with no symptoms to end up with 100 people unwell, right?
Yeah.
So I'm glad it was framed in a way that was trying to remove stigma and trying to make us see that we were part of a team, because that's what the research shows is what works.
Well, I'd love to be able to give the creative industries a little bit of either hope or at least an idea of what to plan for going forward. A lot of my friends, including myself, make at least part of our living or our whole living performing. What do you think we're looking at in regards to how long it's going to take before we can actually get back out there again? I mean, are we looking at months or is it going to be potentially a year or two?
I hope in New Zealand it will be more in the months.
Yep.
Although people will still be quite nervous, I think, about other people. But if we can get to the stage where we're, you know, we are in those day after day after day is negative and only the only cases we ever get are people who have, you know, flown into the country and are in quarantine, then that's where we want to be.
Right.
What I would hope, so live gigs and things, you know, these things where we are coming together, they are going to be problematic for so many reasons, right?
Yeah.
Until we get to that stage where we're confident everything's good.
Yeah.
But What the lockdown has showed us is that we can do things differently.
Yes, that's right.
And often those doing things differently might end up with more participation than less.
Mm, yeah.
So I like gigs, but I'm also middle-aged. And sometimes in winter, I love the live music. I want to be at home.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, one of my favorite experiences during this lockdown was, so I'm a big fan of the Beths. We're, uh-huh. In our house, we're a big fan of the Beths.
Yep, cool.
And hearing that the Beths were going to do a live from their house session during
right.
lockdown.
Yeah.
And so, and it was 9 o'clock, which is not really the time for a gig, but hey, you know, it's so if, I also don't drink alcohol. So for me, going out to a gig is not associated with drinking.
Sure.
Otherwise, a 9 o'clock gig might have been a little bit problematic. But 9 o'clock in the morning was all right for me.
Yeah.
And so what we did, I just decided, so we, as a family, we popped it on and we were like, this is awesome. We're going to watch this. So I was still in my pajamas. I'd been up really early and done some radio, I think, done some interviews on radio. So I was still in my pajamas, popped it on, and then I thought, I really fancy doing some baking. So I started making banana choc chip muffins.
As you do?
While the Beths were playing.
Right.
And it was just like one of my best days ever. So I got to participate. And I was like writing on the live stream, where can I make a donation? I want to buy a ticket. Because
right.
you have just made my day.
But the other thing, though, is a lot of the focus is on original artists, you know, doing that kind of thing. But probably a larger portion of the functional music industry is not that kind of thing. It's people playing in bars, as people playing at corporate functions. We've got comedians that do MC work and all that kind of stuff. And
yeah,
that's all redundant when it comes to trying to do live streams, you know? So that's kind of where the question is more. I think there's people in the background going, well, I'm not famous. I don't have a large following on Facebook because I am a wedding, you know, celebrant or something like that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where some of my questioning is coming from as well. And I wonder if there are measures that can be taken. Like, for example, a question I have is, are seated audiences safer than standing audiences? Is there any difference there because they're not kind of right up against each other?
Yeah, well, you can certainly physically distance a bit better. So,
yeah.
there are things where, so I guess my first response is we should be thinking differently moving forward.
Yes, yes.
In ways that, where you can open up access to people who might not normally access, that might be a real win actually for
right.
some bits of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
But then, yes, for those where actually that's not possible, thinking about how do you do things more safely? So is that going to be we keep this physical distancing thing where it's going to have to be, you know, we're in little we're like in little
pods,
pockets or something. You know, it may well be that a standing audience, you can still have a standing audience, but they might be in booths or something.
Right. Yeah,
you know?
Right.
You know, you're corralled into that bit and you're corralled into that bit.
There's a new business opportunity for someone to build some kind of pod or some sort of booth, isn't there? So
you know, outdoors is going to be better than indoors.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true. That's going to be better. But being able to, the really important thing is going to be, it's not just about limiting your contacts with others. It's going to be, how do you identify those who are most at risk because they have been in touch with someone?
Right.
So that's going to be the tricky thing going forward, I think, is going to be, you know, there's lots of like, well, we should be using these contact tracing apps and stuff. And, you know, if we're going to go down that route, I mean, it has to be down a route that people are comfortable with using them. So
yeah.
It's, you know, we see some countries are going down the basically your data belongs to us. There's no such thing as privacy. And you have no idea who else we're going to share that with. This is not just about your health, you know. And there are really legitimate questions
yeah.
about this.
Of course, yeah.
And it doesn't have to be that way. There are other alternatives where we can do it differently.
Right.
So it's going to be balancing those kind of things where people's right to privacy, but also that really important, if you are exposed, then you need to be able to be identified and tested and potentially quarantined.
Right.
So
yeah.
I think what we need moving forward is a mindset change about the collective good and about the, you know, my rights will be protected, but I do need to be thinking about others. And so how this can fit into every industry, including you know, the entertainment industry. So, yeah, so I think it may well be more outdoor things in smaller numbers
yep.
or if things are big numbers where people are actually separated out and we're in ways where you can identify who has been exposed to who.
Right.
One of the other things, though, understanding the transmission is really important. So for this particular virus, it does look like you know, we're infectious in those early days. And it is like sort of long, repeated exposure to people where that's where the most risk is. So mm-hmm. that doesn't mean that it's not, there is no risk for going to a gig and being, you know, up in somebody's face. Singing, but, you know, there are things like, so for example, singing and stuff, you know, where you are projecting, those are the kinds of activities that are going to be more risky. Yes. So whether actually to go to all these kinds of events, everybody needs to be wearing a mask.
I was going to ask that because singing, as you just said, singing projects, and we know that yeah. a sneeze can carry, what, 9 meters or something potentially. And some yeah. singers really belt it out, especially your kind of your gospel-y singers and your R&B singers and so on. And I'm in my mind, I'm picturing someone on stage giving it everything and just infecting the entire like first 10 rows.
Which hopefully wouldn't happen, but yeah. But it's a, you know, so exactly. So are they, are they behind some kind of, you know, extractor fan? And, you know, yeah. there's like, I'm thinking in our lab, we've got the special lab where we work with an airborne human disease,
right?
Tuberculosis. And so all our work, we can work in there without a mask on, but we work only when we're doing certain things.
Yep.
For other things, we do have to wear masks and stuff. Mm-hmm. But we work with our hands in this special cabinet that's got basically it sort of blasts this curtain of air.
Yep.
And the idea is that that stops anything inside the cabinet from getting outside the cabinet. And then all the air is filtered through these big HEPA filters and stuff.
Yep.
So I wonder whether there may be, this may be a redesign of places where we end up with more, you know, maybe that's what everybody's in. They're in these little corralled things, but it's air pockets, you know, air things that are, and little filters above them that are sucking all of the air out and stuff. And
wow, that's a great idea.
That's how we do it.
yeah, that's a great idea. Because I've also just been wondering about some very kind of practical ideas. Like, it's really normal if you're doing a gig and there's a number of different artists playing that you all use the same microphones. Mm. You know, is that a danger? Is it as simple as just swapping out microphones going to make any difference?
I guess it will depend on what other contact you have with each other.
Right.
So if you're hanging around backstage anyway, then the microphone's probably not going to make that much more difference
yeah.
than if you're sharing other things. So
I'm used to having my own microphone because I hate the smell of beer and like old alcohol and bad breath. So I much prefer to use my own microphone. At least I'm smelling myself. But then I was also thinking about, you know, studios, like rehearsal studios and recording studios and places like that, where, of course, a lot of work is done, especially in the background. And, you know, these places are usually soundproofed and they have limited airflow. People are working right up in each other's face. I mean, they're sharing equipment, they're sharing headphones all the time, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So during the transitional period, while we're trying to get out of the woods here, would it make sense for studios to go through some extra cleaning protocol or to only let limited numbers in at a certain time? Or
yeah, so I would say that it's going to be, so when you're in that kind of environment, then you would be considered a bubble, right? So if
right.
you, you know, if however, and it's not, the bigger the bubble, the more risk there is of
yeah.
either somebody in the bubble being unwell or somebody, you know, or more people within the bubble becoming unwell if somebody's
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
But again, it's about minimizing spread outside that bubble.
Right.
So if you're willing to take that risk and say, okay, yep, there's 10 of us and we want to record this thing, but the 10 of us are going to be a bubble
yep.
and we're going to limit our interactions with other people just in, you know, for a couple of weeks, just in case there was one of us.
Right.
And we're going to make sure that we don't then spread it. And this may well mean that you all go and you live together, you know, or you know, that you really seriously think about what does that mean about you moving back to your back outside to your normal bubbles
right.
once you've been, you know, at the end of a day recording, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
because then your bubble is not just the 10 of you in the studio, it's the potentially, you know, 50 people that you all live with and stuff like
right.
that. And yeah. that then becomes, and if any of those are then going off and doing something else, well, now you can see how exponential spread happens,
yeah.
right? So saying, you know, yeah, we'll be a bubble for a couple of, for however long we're going to do this,
mm-hmm.
And then maybe a little, and then the incubation period at the end of that, so at least a couple of weeks, and then before the next people use it, yes, there's a clean that we you know decontaminate all the stuff that people have been touching,
right,
in order to make sure that if they are there and they have been, you know, touching everything, that it doesn't transmit that way if there are if there is virus and stuff on everything. And then everybody's just really good about washing their hands. I mean, yeah. That's not something we should lose at the end of this pandemic because it will protect us against all sorts of things.
Right. Well, how big does a bubble have to get before it's basically pointless? I mean, you know, if, like on a film set, for example, shooting a TV show or something, there's loads of people there. You know, all sorts of crew members and actors. I mean, if there's 100 people on set, is that no longer a bubble? Is that just starting to take the piss?
Well, it's more risky. It's more than just that bubble. It's about where they go afterwards and who, because then you've got 100 people who potentially all have another bubble of their own. That's maybe, you know, another 5 people, and then that becomes 500.
Right.
Which is taking the piss.
Yeah.
So it may well be that a film set, as long as it was closed.
Yep.
Could be, yeah, we will not interact with anybody outside of this.
Right.
And if there is something that happens within our bubble of 100, it will be limited to our bubble of 100.
And obviously trying to, you know, decrease those numbers to a skeleton crew as much as is possible.
Yeah, yeah.
Any tips on cleaning when it comes to either cleaning hard surfaces or things, soft surfaces like headphones?
There are all sorts of really expensive products that you probably don't need. Basically just good kind of normal disinfectants. There are some things like for example, a studio, you could presumably do this like fogging thing where you can fog with, I think it's called activated hydrogen peroxide or something. So there are things that are really effective.
Right.
And that very quickly kind of dissipate afterwards. That's the sort of thing. So there are companies that will be making really exaggerated claims. Mm-hmm. And then there will be really good information about actually it's just good, thorough cleaning. That's important.
Just normal old cleaning.
Normal.
Yeah.
Yeah. But just really good at it.
A lot of it.
It becomes more important if there are like nooks and crannies that are more difficult to get to.
Yeah.
So if you've got mics and things that are actually, it's going to be hard. I mean, although saying that, spraying stuff with 70% ethanol,
right,
which is fairly easy and, you know, it very quickly just disappears, you know, it dries off. I mean, that's pretty good.
Is this going to be a daily thing, do you think, especially for something like a studio at the end of each day?
So,
you know,
it will depend on who else is in the studio. So, for example, if it's only being used by that bubble,
right,
then it would be advisable to clean it every day. But if nobody else is coming in, then you could sort of get away with probably doing it less.
True.
It's more if you've got different groups coming in.
Yep.
On a particular day that it would need to be cleaned between them. Yeah.
Now I've got to ask, just to begin to wrap up, because it's a music-based podcast, is the spelling of your name a reference to Susie and the Banshees?
Yes, of course it is.
Because that's the only other time I've seen that spelling. So your folks were fans of them or something?
No, my parents were, my mum was a Rolling Stones fan.
Oh, right, nice.
And my dad liked sort of Mike Oldfields and things like that, of tinkly electronic-y type stuff. My name was Susanna, but everyone used to call me Susie, and they used to spell it in lots of different ways. So my family had a way of spelling it, but everybody else spelled it like 101 different ways. And then when I was 16, I became very good friends with a rather delicious looking young man who was a big fan of Susie and the Banshees. So he'd inherited his older brother's record collection.
Right.
And so it had all sorts of things. And so he got me into Susie and the Banshees. He got me into Bauhaus and various other sort of 70s, 80s kind of, you know, new romantic goth bands.
Yeah.
And he started spelling it that way. And then it just kind of stuck. And then I eventually changed it officially. Yeah. And so I've just turned 45. So I've been Susie with too many vowels.
Yeah.
For 2/3 of my life versus the other way.
And do you regret it now that you've been having to explain to people for many years how to frickin' spell it?
Do you know what? I just love it when people try.
Yeah.
What really riles me is when people email me or write something to me and they spell it Susie spelt some other way.
Yeah.
Because it's like, so you know how it's pronounced. But it's too hard to spell it. So you're going to spell it not even not like my name. So I'm all for, you know, if you miss the X, if you miss the second S, if you miss any of the vowels, I'm all good with that.
Right.
It's like, it's absolutely fine. Just give it a bash. Like even my grandmother was giving it a bash. So
it's not very dyslexic friendly, I have to say. I'm quite dyslexic, and going back and forth with your agent every single time I'm like, okay.
I was like, what is it?
I still can't remember.
But it's really easy. It's I-O-U. So I just think of IOU.
IOU, all right.
And then it's then got after an
that,
X in it.
But then after that, it goes crazy with an X in it. What? Anyway, well, on behalf of our listeners and myself, I'd like to say thank you for your service to New Zealand over the last few months. It's not easy to put yourself out there and stand up and say what needs to be said and then come under all the fire and criticism that one comes under. So I think that you've done an amazing job. So thank you for that. And I'm sure you've saved a lot of lives because of your work.
Oh,
so,
wow. Yeah. Thank you very much. I'm just so grateful that that I was in a position to do that, that my knowledge was useful.
Yeah. It's like you kind of hope that you'll never be needed, right? But when you are, you're ready.
Yeah, well, it's also interesting because my research is obviously around infectious diseases, and I'd always, you know, as a scientist, I'd always hoped that maybe one day it would be useful. Like,
right.
You know, my research is around finding new antibiotics, and I was like, oh, you know, we probably won't find one. But if we do, wouldn't it be awesome?
Yeah.
But to realize that actually it was my skills as a scientist combined with being able to communicate that science that has actually become the most important thing.
Exactly. No, that's a great point because, of course, people who are really immersed in that world can sometimes talk in a different language, can't they?
Yeah, well, and we're all like that. So whatever field we're in, we have jargon.
Yes, that's right.
And it's by talking to people outside of our field that we go, oh, does that, okay, that word doesn't mean what you think it means or what I think it means, you know. So, yeah, the thing is that I've spent the last 10 years just sort of motivated to learn to communicate differently, to share some of the stuff I'm passionate about.
Right.
And so in many respects, I feel like I've been training for this pandemic for 10 years. Mm. Not that I ever actually ever wanted to be in a position like this, but I'm really grateful that I have had the opportunity that I've had. You know, I've done podcasting and blogging and all sorts of things, and it's turned out to be really useful.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. And
my pleasure.
And I think it's going to mean a lot to a lot of people to get some actual, proper, useful, pragmatic feedback and ideas and plans and so on. So.
And I'm looking forward to all the gigs in my living room, please.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right. No worries. Lovely to talk to you.
Well, hopefully that was interesting and helpful to everybody. I would like to say a special thanks to Dr. Wiles for taking the time to talk to me. I'd like to say thanks to her agent, Jane, who helped put this whole thing together. And ultimately, hopefully that gives us all a bit more information and food for thought about how to move forward in this uncertain time. You can follow us on Instagram.com/don'tgiveupyourdayjob. You can follow us on facebook.com/don'tgiveupyourdayjob. Our regular listeners will be impressed that I actually know the links this time. I looked them up. I know. I planned a little bit. So there you go. Go to those places, follow us, comment, share, all the usual stuff. Look after yourselves, and we'll see you again on the next episode. Cheers.
If you find what we're doing useful and you like this podcast, please do like, share, and subscribe, and give us a review on iTunes.